Hi, everybody. Edith here. Listen, Ben and I here at Soundtracking just wanted to wish you well. Hope that you're all safe and well and looking after each other and your loved ones. And just to say that over the next coming weeks and months, possibly, we want to try as much as possible and bring you a weekly episode of Soundtracking so that, well, slightly selfishly, so that we have something to take our mind off things, but also hopefully something for you guys to enjoy as well. And where we had a number of guests lined up over the next couple of weeks for various new releases, obviously that's kind of gone out the window because releases have gone back. But what I have done is reached out to a number of people to see if they would be up for coming on and recording a remote chat. So I've had a ridiculous amount of response and positive response from people. So this is amazing news. Thank you so much to everybody. So very much looking forward to catching up at some point with the likes of Isabel Waller-Bridge, Alexandra Desplat, Riz Ahmed, Warren Ellis, who very kindly agreed to chat at some point. So we'll try as much as we can to keep bringing you the podcast every week. And if nothing else, it may well give you an option and suggestions of things that you can watch to help pass the time at home as we find ourselves in this crazy situation. And our guest on the latest episode of Soundtracking that we recorded a few weeks ago is an Australian composer who has worked for a wide range of critically acclaimed directors, including Ridley Scott. Jed Kurzel's latest project is the brilliant True History of the Kelly Gang, which sees him continue his long-standing partnership with brother Justin, a previous interviewee on this show. The pair worked together on Snowtown, Macbeth and Assassin's Creed, while Jed also provided the score for Jennifer Kent's The Fantastic Babadook and John McLean's brilliant Slow West and Sir Ridley Scott's Alien Covenant, of which plenty more shortly. First, a word from our friends at The Economist. Now, our world is a volatile place at the moment, so now more than ever, I'm definitely looking for intelligent, insightful news that I can trust. Whether it's the pressing and frightening matter of the coronavirus, politics, science, tech, or the environment, I want to sift through the noise and get to the facts. The Economist does just that and plenty more besides. For instance, I was taken by an article about how live-action remakes of animated classics are big business for Disney at the moment, not least because we've featured several on this podcast, including Beauty and the Beast, Lion King and Aladdin. Indeed, Beauty and the Beast became the highest-grossing film of its genre within days of release, earning a staggering $1.2 billion at the box office against a budget of $300 million. The Economist is the smart guide to the forces changing your world. Get your free copy of The Economist now. Just text SOUND to 78070. That's SOUND to 78070. And so to Jed and his score for The True History of the Kelly Gang. Now, while the film is basically an Antipodean Western, Jed was keen to avoid the clichés of the genre, as evidenced by this cue, the dress. Jed, thank you so much for coming and doing our podcast Soundtracking. You've scored some of our favourite films, my favourite films, Slow West being one of them.
Oh, yeah.
Which we'll get to in a minute.
Okay.
But I want to talk about the true story of Kelly Gang, which I loved it. I thought it was brilliant.
Oh, excellent.
And I loved the journey that the music had along with the characters.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask if that was what the conversations you had with Justin about that in terms of the purpose of the music, because it's quite sparse.
Yeah.
But when it's there, it's got a real purpose.
I think the landscape played a really big role in the score. I think exactly what you said there, that it's kind of sparse, but it's there. And when you really kind of feel it, it's there. And that to me is what the Australian landscape is like. It's so big and imposing and expansive, but it's also kind of waits in hiding kind of thing.
Yeah. So, predatory.
Yeah. it's unforgiving, and if you kind of mess up there, yeah. you know about it. So that played a huge part in how we approached it. I mean, I've been living away from Australia for the last five years, so it's been really interesting seeing it, picking on up details about the place that would have passed me by in the past.
Was it memories, or did you go back, or did you...
I'd been back 3 years prior to that. I was in visiting a friend who lives in an Aboriginal community in the Alice Springs, and I started seeing the place just so differently and really noticing the landscape and noticing, I guess, the space, but also just how, I don't know, Australia to me is like this landscape of sort of line drawings, you know, like kind of charcoal drawings or something like that. And I'd never seen it like that before. I'd always seen it as just kind of dense, sort of gritty.
Yeah.
So I think I'd remembered that. And then I think just as the footage came in, it was just, incredibly inspiring, and they also were shooting it in places that I hadn't seen before, and particularly that region of Victoria that had been burnt in the previous bushfires.
It's otherworldly in a way, in that you're kind of watching it and going, God, where is that? Is that real? Is it?
Yeah.
It's got an element of sci-fi to it, weirdly, in places as well. It does. Which is incredible.
It does. It can be quite an alien landscape.
But beautiful and kind of, even though it looks... can look terrifying, it really is it hypnotic in a way.
It is hypnotic, and I think there have been films in the past that have really exploited that. Like, I mean, one of my favourites is Picnic at Hanging Rock, and I think that does it beautifully in that it's almost like the landscape just swallows those guys up at the end.
Yeah.
And I kind of love watching, I mean, I kind of like watching Australian films for that, where these kind of human stories are played out in amongst this landscape that feels at any time could just kind of wipe them all out completely.
Yeah.
And it is such a landscape that we don't quite, I mean, we really, outside of the Aboriginal community, we don't understand it.
You know,
we have no understanding
that connection
of its connection. And also, I mean, the other massive influence was the wildlife as well. So I know they had an intention of turning a lot of that up, where usually in Australian films they turn them down. You know, it's annoying to hear all those birds and everything else. So, yes, and I love the sound of Australian birds. I think they're amazing, and they were a huge influence on it as well.
working with Justin over such a, you know, a large number of films, do you always get involved at a certain point, or is each project different? And what point were you, did you start work on this?
No, it's always at the same point. It's, I guess, when he starts something, because we're brothers, we'll just talk about it anyway. Yeah. So I always kind of feel like we never really sit down and have a specific,
so this is what I want.
A specific yeah. meeting about anything. Yeah. It's always we're kind of talking about something else, and then the yeah. process sort of kind of might just spark something up. But yeah, so I think we kind of live with it from the beginning. So I kind of hear the trials and tribulations of the shoot and everything else as yeah. he's going, and then by the time I kind of get there, I understand sort of where they're at, and I think we both sort of come from a perspective as well of letting the work sort of dictate where yeah. it wants to go, rather than us forcing anything on it. Mm-hmm. It's like, just kind of keep it open and keep it free. And
do you go on set?
No, I don't. I haven't found it necessary, just because I feel like it's the images that I'm responding to, and that's what everyone else is going to be responding to. Yeah. I mean, there have been, particularly with the Australian films he's done, if I've known an area or had a relationship with it, then yeah, I may think about going back. I think his first film, I did go back.
It was funny because we're at like episode 180 something now in the podcast. Right. And Justin was on episode 20.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which around Assassin's Creed time.
Oh, wow.
Which
okay,
was
so
amazing.
That's four years ago.
Is it? Wow, crikey. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Time flies.
Yeah.
But it was really brilliant because we talked quite a lot about you and about how you used to play tennis.
Yeah.
And then how music then just became your thing. And if you don't mind me asking, I wanted to find out what it was that from music that kind of pulled you towards it, if it was a specific thing or...
It's really strange. I mean, it was all I did in my childhood was play tennis, and had a kind of quite imposing father who that's kind of what he wanted as well.
Yeah.
And all the while I was doing this, music was like the refuge.
Mm-hmm.
And I just loved it. And I spent most of my time with headphones on when I wasn't playing tennis.
Yeah.
And in Australia at that time, the only place, if you couldn't sort of afford records or things like that, we would you could get cassette tapes from the library.
Yeah.
So I used to ride my bike to the library and I would just book everything that I could. And it would be something that I liked because the tape cover looked great, mm-hmm. or something else, or I might know one song or whatever. And I just discovered this library had the most incredible collection of music. And I just discovered all this music and
what kind of
stuff? Some tape. I mean, just early things like the Velvet Underground, and you know, I mean, like going into that kind of, there's like a big eye opener, and then that sort of, I guess, you start to find television, and then you go into there, and then suddenly you move on to classical music and film scores, and so it was like one after the other. But I was only doing it. It was a very personal thing. I wasn't talking to people about it, or and then I just stopped playing tennis because I was sick of it, and I kind of, it was a bit of a, what's the worst kind of thing I could do?
Like, Dad's got tennis over here.
Yeah.
What's over
the
other side?
It's to kind of not try and make it really obvious that I'm not trying, so that he kind of loses interest. Mm. And it was, you know, it's, because I actually did enjoy playing. But yeah, so I think once I'd finished that, I was sort of left with music, and I just started teaching myself how to play, and
wow.
yeah, and then it kind of just spiraled out from there until I got to the point where I felt like I could do it in public.
<laughs> You know? Take the headphones off.
It was just kind of one of those things where I was obsessed with it. Yeah.
Can you remember any of the soundtracks that really resonated with you through that time?
I remember The Cook, The Thief, His Wife. That one, I remember that being a really kind of like, whoa, what's this?
Thank you.
And then also too, around that time in Australia, there was a TV channel that was mainly just international news and international films. Mm-hmm. And it was basically for, I guess, mainly pegged at immigrants. And so in the mornings you'd have Chinese news, then Polish news. And so everyone kind of their own. Yeah, and it was just one channel. But on Friday and Saturday nights, they just played the most amazing, I mean, what we would call over there foreign films. But through watching this channel, I discovered Morricone and not just the Westerns, but mostly the Italian giallo films, which I didn't even know there was a genre of this that existed. But the thing that really stood out was the music of these kind of strange horror films that were coming out of Italy. That's where I kind of got onto him as well, and then found the Westerns and everything else through that.
An experience for you though when you're writing music for as a band, and if you're writing music to picture, because it's such a wonderful kind of full circle in terms of, you know, Justin doing the videos for your band and stuff like that, and then you coming on to score as film, and then it's brilliant.
I mean, the whole process is kind of, I mean, it really has been a very natural sort of we've never had to push anything. It's just kind of like, it just sort of, we feel like working with each other or we get together and do stuff. I mean, we were like that as kids as well. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there is a big difference between the two. I mean, it is quite a leap going from one to the other. But I think you're kind of unrestricted in film in some ways, because the shackles are off. You're sort of you can go anywhere you want to within the limit of what the film wants, and that's kind of it. And the film will always say, I don't want that, or I want this. And,
Well, he talked about Macbeth being an example of, you know, you having to go through a process of different types of scores almost for that until that marriage of the two was right.
Yeah, I mean, I scored that and then threw it away.
Like, crikey.
I mean,
it was, I hope we get to hear that at some point. That's kind
there's
of,
like,
know,
one piece, I think, left in the film that is from there, and it's just one of those things, you know.
The composer's cut, that's what we need.
Yeah, that's... Well, I mean, my description of what that score was like was that I remember it was kind of like, it was all right. And then I just sort of, it just dawned on me that it wasn't working. And Justin said to me, like, why don't you think it's working? And I said, it's like, you know, when like there's an oil slick, you see those pictures of oil slicks and all the cormorants and the birds are just covered in oil and everything just looks really heavy and it just looks oppressive. And I said, that's what this score
is. That's what my score is. Wow.
I just felt
You're
like
harsh
it was
Craig
this
on yourself.
Well, yeah, and he laughed and kind of went, all right, what are you going to do about that?
Give me another.
Yeah. Well, then I kind of had these other ideas of maybe there was a way of using some of those things that I had there, but just not making it so sort of one thing. And then, I had other ideas about how I thought it should sound, but I just hadn't worked out how to get there with it. And then I kind of, I started working with the LCO, and we started sort of experimenting with different things, and that started to lead. So I think a lot of it too was like I'd spent a lot of time in a room on my own, and it was time to kind of get out there and collaborate. And,
you need some sunlight and communication with people.
Yeah.
It's really interesting as well when you think about, you know, when films are put in those boxes of the genres that they sit with. And what I love about your scores is your scores don't sit in those boxes. Mm. And that you really almost kind of challenge the expectation of the score of a certain genre of music. I hope you take that as a compliment because it's meant as one.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah,
you know, it's like the story of Kelly Gang is, it's kind of a Western. It's kind of, you know, there's, but it's, but the score is really quite indescribable because it does go on that journey and it does fulfill so many different things as well. Mm. Is that deliberate to fight against the sort of genre in a way, I guess?
I think so a little bit because I sometimes feel like if I'm doubling down on the what's in front of me, I kind of get bored or I don't feel like it's – I mean, it's just, I just don't feel like something's – that other thing that's not there is appearing and I kind of feel like film music – There is something when you're given the film without the music, there is something there that you're just not seeing yet and it's like the music – should be the thing that brings that out and whether that's an abstract idea or what, but it's I guess that's kind of what you're always going for. And sometimes it just happens. And other times it's actually really, really difficult. And almost you kind of feel like that doesn't exist. It's like the film just wants this sort of, yeah. But I mean, I always try and head in that direction first, I think.
When you were thinking about instrumentation for this film, Was that a conscious thing as well in terms of things that you wanted to use, things that you wanted to avoid, and how you would make those kind of traditional sounds sound different, I guess, as well?
Yeah, I think I look at that landscape and just the earth. I mean, it is obviously organic and kind of rustic, and I wanted those kind of instruments. But I definitely, because of the way the film was being approached, and it was like the way we sort of, I don't know, chew on the bones of history or something like that, where there's a myth and then we kind of keep circling around it and circling around it until it becomes something else. And in this modern day, it has become something else again, the myth of Ned Kelly. Yeah. And I kind of wanted the music to reflect that in a modern, so it's got a modern sort of tinge to it, that something else is there that's not quite, it's traditional, but it's not. And again, also, it was just the landscape. I kind of felt like it should be integrated into the feeling of that landscape. So things are kind of earthy and feels like could have been made with pieces of bark or you know, birds kind of squawking as well or that kind of thing. Thank you.
It's really funny you say that because about the kind of contemporaneness of it, because you kind of, you're watching it and you kind of think you're watching a film set now almost at times, and then there'll be something that will remind you that, oh no, it's set, you know, whenever kind of thing as well. It's really, and the use of music is really good as well after that first kind of act where we enter Man. And that use of that track as George is kind of, I mean, George is phenomenal in this film.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
That kind of weird contortion of him bent over is like bending your head, working out, hold on, how's he doing that? It's like, bloody hell. So even that, but then also like that brilliant, funny little song that Russell sings by the table, you know, and all that, those kind of, it's just wonderful little moments peppered throughout the entire film that involve music in different ways.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, it was interesting that he used those songs that George and the other actors had written. I mean, they got together and formed a band to basically create some camaraderie.
I love that.
With that gang. And
was that their idea or Justin's
idea? That was Justin's idea. So I mean, good. I think he'd been, I remember him sort of saying to me, is like when we're all in bands and things like that, is that the camaraderie within a band and particularly after a show, that kind of when everyone's sort of finished and standing around. And he just said, like, you know, there was always an energy to that that was just unbeatable, you know, and everyone kind of felt 20 foot tall and just kind of, and I remember him saying, it's like, if you could harness that, like, that's pretty much what these kind of, this gang is, is a gang of boys who feel invincible. Mm. So, having those songs in there, I guess going back round, having those songs in there, it sort of influenced what I was doing as well, because it kind of is grassroots sort of stuff and feels immediate as well. I mean, the score was, the way we did it as well was to never think too much about it, was to just kind of put it on and go, yep, that works, and it feels really good, and, you know, massage it a little bit, but, you know, instead of sort of sitting there and going, and then this happens, and then there was none of that.
I want the music to make me feel this way, that way. It's kind of not manipulating you at all as an audience member.
No, it's a feeling in there and a tone.
It's funny because when we spoke to Sam Riley about lots of things, and we talked about Control, the film we did with Anton Corbijn, and he said that originally Anton was going to have them miming as Joy Division, and then they all kind of talked amongst themselves, the actors, and they secretly started practicing and playing the songs, and then they went to Anton, can we show you something? And then he was like, oh, wicked. And then checked it, you know, can we film this? And kind of did that. I love that kind of organicness of collaboration.
Yeah.
And whilst the project's on the go as well, you know, it's.
Absolutely. And I mean, just mirroring the relationships in the film as well.
Yeah.
And doing something. But also, I mean, that, I can imagine how much fun that would have been to, just to start playing.
Yeah. Can we talk about life outside the brothers?
Yeah.
If that's all right.
Absolutely.
Well, when's John going to make another film? Because, I mean, come on.
He has one.
Come on.
I know. It's getting a bit like that. I know. I feel the same way. But, he has an amazing script that seems on and then off and on and then off.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure where it's at now, but. Yeah.
Slow West was so good.
Yeah, I mean, I loved working on that film and loved working with John.
And what made you want to do it?
Well, I was in Australia and I was coming over here to do Macbeth and spend some time here. And then Seesaw called me, John and I had a meeting, and it was just great because I mean, I'd done Snowtown, I think I'd done the Babadook and a couple of other things. And John was kind of like, it's weird. It's like, I don't know if you really are the right fit, because it's like you've done all this sort of dark stuff. And he was going like, I want a melody. Like, I want something I can kind of – and I had actually sort of been starved of doing that for quite a while.
Just, you know, wanted,
like,
to be happy. Like,
yeah, kind of. But also writing a song almost, you know, that was kind of where he was coming from. So I felt really liberated. It was great. And then within sort of 3 weeks we had it. It was really quick, yeah. Well, that's all they'd sort of given me in between Macbeth to do it.
Yeah. Do you like that pressure?
Well, I mean, he started out, I was like, oh, it's not going to be much music. And then, so it became a lot more pressure than what it was.
It's because you produce such good stuff. It's like, I need more.
I really loved doing it. And it came, I mean, the crux of it came over a particular 2-day period of writing that was like suddenly sort of, well, that's it. And John was great. He would kind of come in and listen to things and go, yeah, great, love it, and walk out. And he just, I mean, coming from a musical background, yeah, I think he just knew, and you both knew, and nothing more needed to be kind of said. He just felt it, and it felt great. So, yeah.
Were you a fan of the Beta Band?
Love the Beta Band.
So they're the one band I want to reform. You know, everyone does that thing of going, oh, my God, after 4, you know, it's like, oh, God, every time it's like, please.
Yeah.
When I see Steve Mason, I'm kind of like, come on.
What does he say?
Just goes mute.
Right. They're one of those bands that
they've all kind of gone off into their, you know, own little, but it'd be amazing at like Glastonbury or something 1 year.
It'd be incredible. And I mean, that John, I think John sort of, they're always teasing with, you know, there's exhibitions of, you know, them archives of their work and stuff. So, but yeah, I was a fan anyway beforehand, but also too, this film arrived. And on my sort of, what was the first time I watched it, and John had been editing it, and it was unreal. Like it was like a filmmaker who went, this person knows exactly what they want to do. It's like, but and it was, I mean, him coming from a background of collage and sort of self-taught,
comes from emotion then, doesn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely. And it's total instinct. So it's like, yeah, there's some rough edges around the places. And if you didn't know he was like that, you were going, well, what is this? But I remember just watching and thinking it was amazing. It's like that someone had put this together, and you know, he was then got together with an editor and they polished it up. But, you know, it was one of those films that was like, this is just fantastic straight off the bat, yeah.
Did he have any temp music on it?
I don't think he did. I can't remember. He might have had one or two things, but I can't remember what they were.
Where do you stand on the temp music?
I mean, do you ask this question to Alan?
No, but it's quite funny. Like, there's so many different responses. I don't ask it every time, but it always comes up mostly. So you have some composers who demand to see the film without temp music.
Yeah.
You get some directors who don't like using temp music. You get some directors who use temp music and they go, just give me the same as this.
Yeah.
There's so many different camps to it. But, you know, I want to hear from the composers on that side of thing more so than anything because...
Well, it's just a difficult thing. I mean, it's like, is that thing bands have, the demo artists?
Yeah.
Where they just can't, the demos always sound, they do the demos and everyone loves them.
Yeah.
And then the whole band goes into record and they just never match the demos because everyone's been listening to the demos for 6 months. And that's kind of what this is like. It's just someone is just editing with the same music over and over again and cannot hear anything else being over it.
Yeah.
Then so there have been films, where we've had temp and just kind of ignored it. And then there's been others sometimes kind of – I mean, it's weird because I sometimes get films that have my music over them temped.
That's nice.
Which is nice, but it's also kind of weird as well because it's like, well, I've done that. And I'm kind of doing it again, but a little bit different. So that's that. It's really flattering, but it's kind of you know the process that you took to get to those pieces of music. But I prefer it without.
Yeah,
absolutely.
M. Night Shyamalan had a great analogy to temp music where he described it as a bit like an ex-girlfriend that you're almost trying to kind of replace every time. It was just, it was so funny.
Yeah.
It was good.
But there's nothing worse than sitting in it than making music that for a film that's had temp on it. And you're sitting there with a director and they're listening to your piece over it and then they kind of finish that and go, can I just hear it with the temp again? And this just can go on and on and on. And it's like... It's impossible to match that, what's been there, because yours is being listened to twice, whereas theirs has been listened to 100 million times. So.
When you come into something as well that has a kind of history to not the film as such, but something like Alien Covenant, which obviously has that history of the previous films that have gone before it and, you know, Jerry Goldsmith's original score and all that kind of thing. But to come in and work on that, was there any talk of the previous films and what that relationship that had with this film?
Yeah, definitely. Because, I mean, when I watched the first cut, Jerry, the Goldsmith cues were there from at the beginning and it was like, we're not moving on these ones. Like, they're staying. And I kind of liked how they were using it because instead of something like maybe Star Wars where they went, we want Star Wars, but just a kind of different version of Star Wars. So we still, when Darth Vader comes in, we still want to know that, you know, but just something a bit different, but with the same notes. Whereas they were using this one as in like, here's Ridley's Alien again. Here's the territory you're in.
Yeah.
Sit in your seats, feel comfortable. We're going to take you back into kind of Ridley's world. And then when they get to that next planet, so everything's sort of familiar and you're kind of excited because you're hearing that music again. It's like, we're back in the cinema. And it's kind of peppered throughout that first quarter of the film. And then once they hit that planet, it's kind of like that was always the idea. It's like, well, off you go. You can, they were always saying to me, that's when you can go for it. Yeah, so it became a conceptual idea that that worked rather than it being, well, let's just kind of copy all the music.
Do performances inspire you?
Performances?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And particularly Snowtown was a big, that first film, because a lot of those actors weren't actors. I just never got sick of watching them. I just thought they were unbelievable. And then Macbeth, I think, was another one that just those two. Yeah, and I still watch Marion's out damn spot speech and that, and that's, and just the way we all got there with that scene, and I still think it's one of the most beautiful things I've seen. Yeah, you know, you're watching actors and kind of they just making choices that you're like, wow, you know, that's amazing. Did you even, you know, was that something that you'd thought of before, or did it just happen at the moment? And I guess I think it's wonderful you're sort of seeing people sort of making mistakes and doing amazing things with those mistakes and scenes. And I think it's, yeah.
Are the band still going?
No, I just haven't had time. And
that's a nice position to be in.
I'd like to, but I mean, we'd live in different countries as well, so
you could support the Beer Band.
We could if they. Yeah, well, I have to. Well, by the time they get back together, John's film will get up, so they won't be doing anything.
But when you're not scoring, are you still writing music?
Yeah, definitely. There's nothing better than being able to kind of create anything without having any boundaries. It's great, and it's kind of, there's no time frame or anything. You can just, and I think it just keeps ideas flowing, and you never know, there could be a project that comes up that you've actually been making something that feels really good for it, or come across an idea that's like, oh, okay, that might be something I can explore later on.
The Babadook as well was an extraordinary film, and in so many ways it was just brilliant. How was that to work on and approach, and like a pretty strong genre as well, in terms of you know, there's such, with those types of films, there's an expectation, isn't there, particularly with a score?
Yeah, there is, and that film came out of a period where those films weren't being made.
Yeah,
and I remember it was that film and It Follows were the two that kind of, oh, hello, something else is happening here, and we're going back into the sort of psychological Rosemary's Baby kind of land. But in saying that, at that period, if you're making a horror film, people expected Saw or, you know, something
a
really, like one of those. Is sort of, that's where horror was at that point. So those earlier screenings, test screenings and that, were really strange, you know, where we were still working out sound and music and things like that, because it was sort of like, is it a horror? Is it a thriller? is it a drama? And it's like, it's all of those things.
Yeah.
But you know, people coming out with sort of like, well, it's scary. I didn't jump, or I didn't, you know, but we were kind of never thinking like that.
Yeah.
So we sort of always knew what we were going for.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of times sort of ignoring what people were saying of like, oh, can we have some more jump scares and things like that? And I was like, no, there's none of that going on here. It's just this freaky kind of feeling through the whole film. Thank you. I mean, Jen is just such a wonderful person to work with, yeah, and one of the funniest people I know. And I mean, in her films that are so quite, I mean, the same with Justin, they're quite dark, and both of them have really great senses of humor.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I remember Jen would come round to my house in Australia and we'd listen to things and kind of just sort of laugh and about things I'd done or whatever, or she'd have stories about how the film was going or whatever and just be quite self-deprecating and we'd just kind of laugh about that. But again, it was kind of this really sort of organic process that we sort of came around to a particular sound and then got there at the end. And I mean, I remember that one particularly was that I had this studio space at the back of my house in Australia and I had a big gum tree that went over the top of it and I had a family of possums on that we would live in there, and I'd be up late at night, 2 o'clock in the morning, and the possums would jump onto my roof and create like all kinds. So then I'd get massive branches coming down and everything else. So it always just felt like someone was throwing kind of dead bodies onto the top of that.
You were living the property.
Yeah. And so then I would, then I started really noticing a lot of the sounds and I started kind of miking things up outside and kind of going, oh, maybe there's something in this. Or a lot of the time I'd finish doing something and I'd go and sit outside and turn it up really loud and just listen to it with again, this Australian landscape and its animals and everything else. And I would just listen to the music with everything else going on as well and kind of find ideas out there like that. And that's pretty much how that score came about. Yeah.
Possums. Yeah. I love it. Oh, thank you for your time. I'm sorry about my crazy, stupid voice.
That's all right.
But we got there in the end nearly. And I'm really excited to see what's next as well for you.
I am too.
And that beat a band reunion as well.
Yeah, I think we'd all love to see that.
Jed, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Cheers. From Jed Kerzel's score to The Babadook, that's the end credit music rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with the Australian composer. My huge thanks to Jed for taking the time to talk to us. Brother Justin's True History of the Kelly Gang was out in cinemas, but of course with current events, we're very much hoping that it will hit the small screens imminently. Please do go and check it out. Head to edithbowman.com to check out my interview with Justin, which I can't believe is 4 years ago. God, time does indeed fly. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We're at Soundtracking UK. And please do also subscribe to our YouTube channel. I'm trying to do a daily update stream for you of just recommendations of things that you can watch and having an open conversation with you. So do head to our Soundtracking YouTube channel to subscribe. Next up then, I'm very much hoping that between now and next week, I have the opportunity to speak to Warren Ellis, who's very kindly offered to chat to me remotely. So I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company next week, along with Warren Ellis. In the meantime, take care.